An undercover detective comes under the gun in a sting operation gone wrong.
Only on 11 Alive News, new details about sting operations underway at an East Point park.
I'm not going to lie, this story shocked me. Right now, parents say they can't even take their kids to the park because they're scared of what they might see.
And a different operation spanning months, hundreds of fugitives arrested, more than 150 guns off our streets, and several children safe. News 4's Austin Brissett has new information on how Operation Triple Beam went down.
In the realm of law enforcement, covert operations are those done in secret without the knowledge of those being observed. In a typical covert operation, an undercover law enforcement officer, detective, or a cooperative member of the public assumes the role of either a criminal partner or a potential victim. They then engage with a suspect as an attempt to gather evidence of their illegal activities. This is what is known as a sting operation, a smaller subset of covert operations. Perhaps one of the most infamous examples of a successful sting operation would be the one conducted during the investigation of Dahlia DiPolito. Throughout the month of July in 2009, Dahlia was actively seeking a hitman to murder her then-husband, Michael DiPolito, for a payment of $7,000. After enlisting the help of one of her ex-boyfriends to pose as a lawyer and convince Michael to sign the title of his house over to Dahlia, she then moved on to asking another ex-boyfriend for help locating a hitman. Ex-boyfriend number two avoided giving Dahlia a yes or no answer. He then took this information directly to the police. Detectives then placed an undercover police officer posing as a hitman in a car and invited Dahlia to meet him in a pharmacy parking lot. Dahlia promptly arrived and entered the vehicle. What you are seeing now is a short snippet of Dahlia captured through a camera hidden in a small hole in the rear passenger seat.
Sure, you want to kill this dude? We really have to. All right. You know, it's just, I'd rather be as less, you know, whatever with you.
All right. We're just going to be asking you questions, although they know it's going to be obvious what it is, and they already know, you know what I mean? But, you know, they're going to ask questions, you know, because that's how they got to do it.
Right.
Okay? Yeah, because I don't know how well you have the pressure. And I'm, you know, because I don't want...
No, I'm not going to, you know, I'm a lot tougher than what I look. I know you see me, you're like, oh, what a cute little girl, whatever. You know, but
you're beautiful.
Thank you, but, you know, I just need to make sure everything's going to take care of.
All right, you're not going to have an option to change your mind, even if you change your mind, I'm talking to...
There's no changing, no, there's no, like, I'm determined already. I'm positive, like, 5,000% sure, like...
Okay.
This footage was recorded on July 30th, 10 days later, on August 9th, the decided date of the hit. The police went to the house of Mike DiPolito and explained the current circumstances. Mike cooperated with the police to pretend that the hit was carried out, and the police called Dahlia to the crime scene.
Listen, we had a report of a disturbance at your house, and there were shots fired. Is your husband Michael? Okay, I'm sorry to tell you, ma'am, he's been killed.
No, he's been killed, ma'am.
I'm sorry.
Listen, right now we need to get you to our police station.
I can't let you stay, man. We have to do our job. We need you to calm down. I'm going to need you to go with these detectives, okay? If you want to help your husband, okay? If you want to help your husband, you need to go to the station with these gentlemen and tell us everything you know about who he knows, who he's connected to.
After being escorted back to the police department, officers withstood more of Dahlia's bad acting in the interrogation room, and it was eventually revealed that this was, in fact, a sting operation.
The game's over with, okay? There's no more games with you and I. Now we're going to get down to serious business. I want to know if you know this guy. Come here. Bring this guy in here. Get over here. Get over here. You know who this guy is?
No.
You've never seen him before?
I've never seen him before. Ever.
Do you know her?
Put your head up and look at her.
Put your head up.
I've never seen him.
What were you doing coming out of her house? Get him out of here. You're going to jail today for solicitation of murder. You're under arrest. That's an undercover police officer. We filmed everything that you did, recorded everything that you did. You're going to jail for solicitation of first-degree murder of your husband.
I didn't do anything.
Did you hear what I just told you?
I heard what you said, but I didn't.
Listen to me. Everything has been recorded. You were photographed in the convertible when you sat his car in the front of CVS. What do you want to do? What do you want to do here?
I didn't do anything.
Listen to me.
I didn't do anything.
You're going to jail.
I didn't do anything. Please, I didn't do anything.
After an additional 8 hours of questioning, Dahlia stuck to her claims of innocence and was formally charged with solicitation to commit first-degree murder. Dahlia would go on to manufacture several false narratives to explain the situation that she found herself in. The first narrative that she devised was recorded during the first phone call that she was granted after her arrest. Strangely, instead of choosing to use this valuable phone call as an opportunity to consult an attorney, she decided to call the man that she was trying to murder, her husband, Michael DiPolito.
Honestly, I can't help you. Don't you understand what just happened?
What they're saying is not true.
How is that possible?
I'm sitting here. It's not true. It's not possible. You wouldn't even give me 2 minutes to talk to you, but it's not possible. What they're saying is not true.
How in the hell did I hear it and see it?
I heard what you heard. It's not true. I heard what you heard and I saw what you saw. Everything they showed you, they showed me.
And how is it not, how are you telling me that?
I am giving you my word that it's not true.
Before trial, Dahlia would state that the audio and video recorded during the sting was actually created using CGI and special effects. When the trial began, she would change her story again, stating that the entire murder-for-hire plot was actually a scheme devised as a way to get Mike on reality TV. After being found guilty at her initial trial, Dahlia's conviction was quickly overturned and a retrial was granted.
On the record at this time, I'm now declaring this case mistried by virtue of the fact that the jury cannot reach a unanimous verdict.
Curiously, Dahlia's second trial ended in a hung jury and forced the state to try her for a third time. The result of the third trial was a repeat of the first. The jury returned a verdict in just under 90 minutes, and she was found guilty again and sentenced to 16 years behind bars.
Three trials later, a conviction today. The Boynton Beach woman immediately fingerprinted and handcuffed.
State prosecutors Laura Lori and Craig Williams hugged out their victory in the courtroom. A statement from the state attorney's office said, "We are pleased that the hard work and perseverance of our prosecutors and staff have led to justice for this victim."
This is just one example of just how effective sting operations can be in not only preventing heinous crimes from occurring, but catching the perpetrator before they can even commit the crime. However, not all sting operations play out so smoothly. In fact, undercover agents are often putting their lives at risk by having close encounters with dangerous criminals. For example, this sting operation in 2017 went south after the criminals the agents were meeting with tried to rob them.
Police say the men in that parking lot were armed and ready to rip off the two men they were meeting with to sell guns, unaware that those two men were undercover Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents.
A security camera records one of the suspects darting from the scene Friday.
And then it shows him running in between the A-line.
And into the traffic on Pacific Highway South in Kent.
I was like, oh my gosh, he got hit by a car. I didn't know he actually got hit. And then we had footage of it.
Jasmine Shenowick
got hit by a car.
Showed us the video from security cameras at Midway Tropical Fish and Pets where she works. Kent police say they were working with undercover federal agents in a sting to buy firearms from a 19-year-old man and his partner.
The suspects attempted to rob our undercover officers. A shootout ensued.
In the gunfire, law officers' bullets took one suspect out with life-threatening wounds, and that black car took the second one down with less serious injuries.
It is clear that sting operations come with a set of risks that in some cases can be fatal. These risks are often too hard to predict, as the investigators do not always know how far their targets are willing to go. There is another type of covert operation with its own specific set of risks. That operation is called Mr. Big. In Mr. Big operations, it is often very clear what these criminals are capable of.
I'm not sure. This one here, this either of us is not ready.
In this case, the man confessing to murder is 71-year-old Gary Handlin, and the man that he is confessing to is a strategically placed undercover agent posing as a local organized crime boss. Going into this operation, agents already possessed enough evidence to believe that Gary was capable of murder. This confession was the last piece that they needed in order to convict him. Following this video, Gary was formally arrested and charged with the murder of Monica Jack, 36 years after her abduction. He was convicted in early 2019. As alluded to using the prior examples, the main difference between Mr. Big and a sting is that sting operations are designed to catch a person attempting to commit a crime, while Mr. Big is another type of covert procedure designed to elicit confessions from suspects who have already committed a crime. For the remainder of this video, we will be taking an in-depth look at the murder of Jack Beauchamp, the investigation that followed, and the Mr. Big operation that uncovered his killer. On a Monday morning in January of 2006, in the city of Calgary, Alberta, a business executive with Moorbank Financial made her way to the 12th floor of the high-rise building where her company resided. The doors were unlocked, and upon entry, she found her co-worker, Jack Beauchamp, bleeding out on the ground, unresponsive. After calling 911 at 7:58 a.m., EMS was dispatched. While still on the phone and waiting for them to arrive, the operator guided her to perform CPR. In the process, it became apparent that Jack's injuries were a result of gunshot wounds to the chest. When paramedics arrived at 8:02 a.m., it was too late. Jack had succumbed to his injuries. They noted that Jack's coffee was still steaming, indicating that this was a very recent shooting. His coworker, who was still by his side, said that she had not seen anybody leave the area, meaning that there was a possibility that the shooter was still in the vicinity.
We discovered a male deceased of apparent gunshot wounds. This incident is being investigated at this point in time. The homicide unit of the Calgary Police Service has been notified.
With downtown workers potentially still in danger, the pressure was on to collect evidence and find the shooter as swiftly as possible. When police spoke to other Moorbank Financial employees to gather more information, they found out that the company was a commercial mortgage lending company, and Jack Beauchamp was the president. The forensic crime scene unit arrived and began to process the scene, including the office where Jack was murdered and a parking garage where his SUV was parked. They determined that Jack was shot at close range with six .22 caliber bullets. According to the Moorbank workers, nobody witnessed the shooting, but they were able to provide a possible motive. Apparently, clients would frequently become upset about not receiving the loan that they were hoping for. In fact, there was one client in particular that Jack had been in the midst of dealing with. His name was Bob Deere. In fall of 2005, Bob made a deal with Moorbank Financial for a mortgage loan and agreed to pay the commitment fee of $18,000. When the deal fell through, Bob refused to pay the owed commitment fee, and this immediately became a point of discourse. While the commitment fee was merely a part of company policy, email exchanges on Jack's computer made it clear that Bob personally blamed Jack. The conflict continued to escalate, and on December 14, 2005, Jack made a phone call to 911.
Calgary Police Officer Fontaine.
Yes, good morning. My name is Jack Beauchamp. I'm calling from a company called Moorbank Financial. Quite honestly, I'm not sure if this warrants police intervention or not. I've received some emails from a client that I've discussed with my lawyer, and it seems like they have crossed the line into the threatening side of things.
What have they said that is threatening?
Well, comments like, if you live like a gangster, you should expect to die like a gangster. And I guess, by way of explanation, I'm president of Moorbank Financial, Inc. We're a commercial mortgage lending company.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think they kind of crossed the line, but...
No, they haven't done anything criminal at this point?
There's been no actions taken.
Not that, sir. The threat itself is not criminal. It's not specific.
Okay.
If they were to say, I'm going to damage your property or I'm going to hurt you or your family or someone you know, then at that point they are committing an offense by uttering a threat. But by saying, if you live like a gangster, you're going to die like a gangster.
Well, that's just one comment. It says, do you realize that someone could hurt you or your business for operating with such unethical, low-life standards?
Still insufficient, sir. They have to say, I'm going to do this to you. That's a threat.
So a veiled threat's not a threat, then?
It's not enough to play charges.
Okay.
I would suggest at this point that you keep everything that you have.
I've done that, yes.
And that if at any point they say something direct, then at that point you've got sufficient evidence to lay charges against them.
Okay. So it doesn't warrant anyone speaking to them and just...
Well, we wouldn't do that anyways. We cannot warrant someone to change their behavior.
Okay. Okay. No, well, fair enough. That clears it up for me on this side of things. Hopefully nothing comes of this.
Hopefully not, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a good day now.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
The next day, on December 15th, 2005, Bob sent another email to Jack stating, "I apologize for wording my letter to you in such a way that it scared you, or seemed to threaten you in any way. I mean no harm to you personally, as I don't even know you. Simply, I was expressing my disgust in your company's unethical business practices." He then ended the email by saying, "We can both walk away from this without getting hurt. But it's up to you, Bob dear." Later that day, Jack responded saying, "The difference between us is that you are a low-life coward." He went on to state, "Go ahead and challenge our agreements in front of the court if you disagree. Stop with the threatening rhetoric and veiled threats. First off, I'm not the least bit intimidated or afraid of you. Second, you are not smart enough to pull off a war of words. Third, you are embarrassing yourself in front of my lawyer, your old partners, the mortgage broker, my staff, and now the police. Maybe it's time you grew up, you moron. Jack Beauchamp." Nevertheless, the arguments continued through email and Bob's name began to spread around Moorbank's office. One employee even showed detectives a note that Jack had given her. It said, "Bob dear, manic depressive, whack job," and included his phone number. Police naturally set their sights on Bob as a suspect. They met him at his house as he pulled into the driveway just hours following Jack's death and promptly arrested him. They detained Bob at the police station for 24 hours, but were forced to release him. They didn't yet have enough evidence to charge him for murder, but he didn't walk away scot-free. He was charged with criminal harassment due to his emails for the time being. The detectives moved on with their investigation by looking through surveillance videos recorded by cameras around the building. Here you can see Jack beginning his day, briefcase and coffee in hand, entering the office building. At 7:49 a.m., he is seen entering the elevator. This was the last time that Jack was seen on camera. After examining the CCTV footage thoroughly, police confidently determined that Bob had not been in the building at the time of Jack's murder. So if not Bob, then who? Continuing to review the footage, there was one individual who stuck out like a sore thumb. This person was wearing sunglasses while it was dark out, and from what the CCTV had captured, it seemed as if he didn't take off his gloves the entire time that he was in the building.
The homicide unit has viewed hours of video from the business at 635 8th Avenue Southwest. And as a result of that, we have identified one person of particular interest, a male, dark hair, a beard, approximately 5'6" to 5'8", weighing about 175 pounds, wearing blue jeans and a dark jacket.
Police were able to confirm the identity of this man from an unrelated traffic stop in September of 2005. The driver was arrested during his traffic stop and was asked whether he preferred his vehicle to be towed or handed over to one of his passengers to take care of it. He chose the latter option, and that trusted passenger was a man named Mohammed Ali Karim. Mohammed had told the officers that he worked for a landscaping company. Investigators decided to look into that landscaping company and discovered that it was owned by none other than Bob Deer. Police were then able to obtain a search warrant for Bob's home and vehicle. In his house, they found a sink full of what seemed to be facial hair, along with an unopened package of razors beside it. Other pieces of evidence included a gun safe with .22 caliber ammunition inside of it, but no gun, as well as two receipts. One from Walmart and one from London Drugs, both from January 15th, the day before Jack's murder. On the Walmart receipt, they found a list of items, including a leather handbag, sunglasses, and gloves. They also found a Greyhound bus pass from Edmonton to Calgary that had the name MLE printed on it, dated for January 15th as well. Investigators now had three locations where Bob Deer had been the day before Jack's murder: the Greyhound bus terminal, Walmart, and London Drugs. So, they decided to check the surveillance footage for each one. When reviewing the Greyhound bus terminal footage, they spotted Bob Deer arriving and then leaving the building with Mohammed, sporting the same black jacket and beard. The next day, on January 16th, at 10:13 a.m., he can be seen returning to the Greyhound bus terminal, but this time he no longer has facial hair. This would explain the shavings found in Bob's sink. The investigators moved on to the Walmart, where Bob and Muhammad can be seen walking together and buying their list of items. Then on to London Drugs, where the men can be seen buying rubbing alcohol and latex gloves. The surveillance footage presented a clear timeline of events to the detectives. On January 15th, Muhammad arrives in Calgary from Edmonton using the Greyhound bus and meets with Bob Deere. The two men make several stops in preparation for Jack's murder. The next morning, Bob drops off Muhammad at Jack's building. Muhammad kills Jack and then flees the scene. Back at Bob's house, Muhammad alters his appearance before being dropped back off at the Greyhound bus to return to his Edmonton home. With all of this evidence stacked up against Muhammad, police were able to obtain a search warrant for his house in Edmonton, where they found clothes that seemed to match the ones that he was allegedly wearing in Jack's building. Unfortunately, all of this evidence was still circumstantial, so months went by without charges being laid against Bob or Muhammad. Muhammad even moved out to Vancouver during this time. However, he had not escaped Calgary law enforcement's radar. They devised a Mr. Big operation in the hopes of getting a confession from Muhammad. Undercover investigators spent several weeks in Vancouver gaining his trust, pretending to be a part of an underground criminal organization that was looking for a new recruit. Eventually, Muhammad scored a meeting with Mr. Big, the boss of this fictional organization. Part of his initiation was to describe in detail other organized crimes that he's been a part of.
So I got in there, the door was open. I called it as a Jack Bouchon. Then he came like this. How can I help you, sir? Good morning. I look pretty scary, man, with the gloves and the glasses, you know. I'm like, hey, good morning, sir. My name is Mike. A buddy of mine sent me here to talk business with you. He's like, well, who's your friend? I said, it's a French guy called Denis. And he's like, Denis. Like, it doesn't matter. But anyways, I would like to talk to you about some money lending for a real estate project and stuff. So he goes, okay, but like, do you have an appointment? Have you called me before? Like, yeah, I called actually before, and I left a message with one of your employees here. I don't know if they did the message. He's like, I don't know. I'm like, okay, can we see each other? I was planning to go with him in the office, and then once he turns his back, I'm just going to take him up. But he said, no, you need an appointment, sir. I'm sorry, I'm really kind of busy. I managed to get him back to the office by asking him for a card, a business card. So he went back to the office. That's when I pulled out the gun, called him. And by when he saw me coming, he kind of ran towards me. That's the mistake I did. I didn't want to kill him. I did not want to kill him. So I'm here. I'm here. He went that way. I just take it out. Of the safe room, came up, look at him, he came at me, I went like this. The moment he saw the gun, he was shot.
A few days after this confession, both Bob and Muhammad were arrested for first-degree murder. They were transported together, and a conversation between the two was recorded.
Listen, I got set up by some undercovers, brother.
Really?
They're telling me you're ratting me up.
Yeah.
And I told them that's crap.
That's crap.
That all the information they got is crap. They got that video clear. It was an undercover man. These undercovers can got me. If they are the undercovers or if it's a trick from the police, I'm not sure here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We made one big circle just so that they could listen to us, and now we're right back where we started. Oh, I know, man. I don't care. I mean, I'm trying to help you, and you're trying to help me because we're friends, you know? We're in the same boat for nothing. So, of course, we're going to help each other, man. It's us against them, right?
Well, I'm just saying nothing.
A property on this street is at the center of this case. The prosecution says Robert Deere had borrowed more than $1 million from Jack Beauchamp to build a duplex here. But the big problem started when that duplex deal fell apart and Deere still owed Beauchamp money.
Their trial began in September of 2007. The prosecution presented their case, saying that in a fit of rage over the $18,000 commitment fee, Bob Deere hired Muhammad Karim as a hitman to kill Jack Beauchamp. They laid out all of the evidence for the jury, including the timeline of events using CCTV footage, the email exchanges between Bob and Jack, the forensic evidence from the crime scene and Bob's house, and Muhammad's full confession. The defense tried to counter this by simply saying it was an accident, that Muhammad never intended to shoot Jack, and there was never a plan to kill him in the first place. Apparently, Muhammad only meant to intimidate Jack, as Bob had specifically instructed him not to use violence. After 4 days of deliberation, the jury had reached a verdict. Robert Deere and Muhammad Karim were found guilty of the first-degree murder of Jack Beauchamp.
I think that the jury was very conscientious and diligent. They clearly considered all of the evidence very carefully. They clearly put a lot of work into it and came up with a just verdict.
We're just thrilled with the verdict. But there are clearly no winners in this situation. So many lives have been changed forever by the actions of these two men. Jack was a wonderful husband and father. The outcome of this trial changes nothing for our family. My husband is gone. My children's father is gone. We miss him every day in our lives, and we cherish the memories we have, but we must try to move forward.
Following this conviction, Bob's defense team argued in the Court of Appeal that the trial judge's instructions to the jury were flawed because she didn't tell the jurors that they had to find Deere paid Karim specifically to murder Beauchamp. So, their conviction was overturned, and the case demanded a retrial.
A new trial began today for two men accused of killing a Calgary businessman. It's the second trial for the duo charged with first-degree murder in the killing of Jack Beauchamp. Nancy Hicks is at the Calgary Court Center with the latest. Nancy.
The trial began today with graphic video of the crime scene. Beauchamp lying in a pool of his own blood in his downtown Calgary office.
The retrial resulted in the amendment of both Bob and Muhammad's charges. Muhammad was found guilty of second-degree murder, while Bob was found guilty of manslaughter. This is due to the fact that the judge was not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that Bob and Muhammad had planned Jack's murder in advance, or that Bob was aware of Muhammad's plan to use violence. Following their convictions, Muhammad challenged the courts again, which resulted in a delay to their sentencing.
A Calgary murderer's sentence is delayed today because he alleges sheriffs abused him. Muhammad Karim was convicted of second-degree murder 1 month ago in the 2006 death of businessman Jack Beauchamp.
Lawyers for Muhammad Karim are still waiting to get access to all of the video surveillance footage from both the Calgary Remand Center and the courthouse. Karim says that surveillance footage will prove he was abused by sheriffs verbally, physically, and sexually. In a telephone interview from jail, Karim says much of the abuse is religiously and racially motivated.
When someone calls me, like I was called thousands of times by officers, I don't let go. Instead, what I do is complain. And that irritates in me, the officers. Retaliation for complaining. I was taken down and just beat up so bad.
A spokesperson from the Solicitor General's office would only say that any time they become aware of potential criminal activity, police are called. Kathari says depending on what they find on the video, sentencing submissions could be affected. And Nirmala, a new date for sentencing will be set once lawyers have a chance to pore over all of those videos.
Muhammad Karim was ultimately sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 18 years. Robert Deere was sentenced to 16 years in prison. However, he had 2-for-1 credit on time already served. Sometimes judges grant offenders credit for the time spent in jail prior to sentencing, which is commonly referred to as pre-sentence custody, pre-trial custody, or dead time. If the judge does give this credit for pre-sentence custody, they might choose to offer enhanced credit, or 2-for-1 credit, wherein, for each day an offender spent in pre-sentence custody, the judge reduces the jail time by 2 days. Therefore, Bob was set to be released in just 4 years. In August of 2015, he was released on statutory grounds after serving 2/3 of his sentence.